I never know for sure where the conversations on this podcast will go exactly. Each one is an adventure. Sometimes interviews start out very specific, very particular topic, but then they blossom, expand, reach out, because mental health, turns out, is complicated. And specific issues touch on other issues very quickly, and it's a much broader and more comprehensive discussion than one might have expected going in, which is good. And so, yeah, that's what happened this week. An issue that unfolded. It's ultimately, in the end, an episode about how to think about yourself and the people you talk to within the context of mental health. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. The topic going into it, the topic as we sketched it out on the whiteboard, what to say to a loved one who you think might have a mental health problem, but who hasn't done anything about it. How do you broach that topic? So going into that, we reached out and got some experts from different walks of life, different backgrounds, locations, and we talked about what to say, what not to say in those situations. But a lot of what we ended up talking about is about taking a minute to think first, how to figure out why you're concerned, what you can realistically expect from a talk like this, how to read and understand another person's boundaries. We'll get those conversations rolling in just a moment. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. Quanah Walker is the Director of Behavioral Health at Health Partners. It's a healthcare provider and insurance company based in Minnesota. He joined us from his home, and his daughter makes an appearance here.
So if you know someone well enough to know that there's reason to be concerned and that they could be experiencing some significant mental health or even substance use disorder concerns, what I would say is you should think about what you know about that person. You know, it's somebody you already have a relationship with, and think about their preferences and what are the things that you think they would appreciate in a conversation like that, and then take that into account. So make it personalized. And when you initially approach the person, you want to be really open-minded and really sensitive as far as if they really truly are experiencing mental health concerns that are impacting their life in a significant way. You know, they're not feeling their best. They're struggling potentially. And so you want to be really respectful of that. And so you want to I would say be gentle in how you broach the subject. And then again, think about what you know about that person. Are there things that you could tap into about what's important to them, or, you know, what matters to them? And, you know, is there a way that you could leverage any of what you know about them in the relationship in that conversation? And then be respectful when you broach the subject and then you start that conversation. If somebody tells you that they don't want to talk about something or that they're not ready for that conversation, you should respect that as much as you can. Of course, you want to be concerned about their safety and their well-being. And if you think there really is immediate danger, you should absolutely think about, are there things you should be doing to mitigate those risks? But if that's not the case, you can always let the person know that you're there and that when they're ready, that, you know, you're able to offer them support.
Quanah Walker works on a project that his employer helped start called makeitok.org. You can get information on mental health issues there, information on how to start a conversation. It's all built around promoting and normalizing regular conversation about mental health.
So they have a website that you can go to. It's makeitok.org. And there's a lot of really excellent information that's been curated. They have ad campaigns. They have a toolkit. They have a lot of really excellent tools and resources that you can use.
Something that I like about the Make It Okay website, it has information on what to say, but also information on what not to say. What should people keep in mind about what not to do when trying to initiate a conversation on a touchy subject like this?
Yeah, you want to be careful about the language you use, and you don't want to use language that's negative, that has a negative connotation, or that's judgmental. And you don't want to be doing things that are going to add to the stigma and make people feel really uncomfortable with talking about it and addressing it. So those are some of the key things that you want to avoid, is when you're trying to have that conversation, doing anything that's going to make people have those really strong negative reactions about what they're experiencing.
Can you give me an example of like a negative way to approach it?
Well, so with the Make It Okay campaign, one of the things that we talk about when we do presentations and we go out and we share that campaign with people is we talk about language. And there's a lot of stigmatizing language. For example, you know, one of the exercises that we do is we say, what are some words that people use when they're talking about somebody experiencing a mental illness? And immediately, when there's an audience participating, they come up with a lot of words like crazy, insane, nuts, wacko. I mean, you can think of so many words that are stigmatizing. And then if you take that exercise and you apply it to a medical condition, people can't come up with those kind of words. Like if you're talking about somebody with cancer, they're not really able to come up with those kind of really negative and judgmental, stigmatizing words and language about that. And then you try to get them to change the way they're thinking about it and flip the script in a way. And so you want them to say, what are some realistic or positive ways that you can talk about people experiencing mental illness?
Yeah. I would think too, there's a lot of othering to it. You know, if someone has cancer, that's still, you know, your Uncle Bill who has cancer, but sometimes with mental illness, it could be, well, that person's in a different world. That person's a different species. And it's a distancing because of, I think, a perceived threat. Like if somebody has a mental illness, then they're dangerous and you better shove them away. And that seems like just the opposite path to go down.
Exactly. And that's something that there's been kind of an evolution in our society. And so many decades ago, when people had mental illnesses, they were often put in institutions and they were separated from society. And there is a lot of stereotypes and a lot of people's opinions about what does that mean when somebody's, quote, mentally ill. Over time, I think that things have been moving in a positive direction. And I think that campaigns like Make It Okay, that's one of the real goals of it, is to help us move forward and help us change the way we're thinking about people that are experiencing a mental health concern or condition. And so the reality is that it's a very small portion of the population experiencing mental illness that, you know, would be in a category where they're truly dangerous or they need to be in an inpatient setting or something like that. Really what we want to do is we want to help people to treat their condition and manage their condition and hopefully stay out of those kind of settings and really be able to participate fully in their lives and improve their functioning. And that's why it's so important to really pull in what's important to someone. So is it their family? Is it their pet? You know, do they like gardening? Is it their career? And then maybe that's part of like, you know, that the idea that if you get help and you get support, that you can do better in all those areas of your life and you can be more present and that it is treatable. Mental health conditions are treatable. And so there's a lot of different ways you can go about that. It doesn't mean that you only have an option of taking medication or that you have to see a therapist. There's a whole spectrum of things. And oftentimes many things can work. Oftentimes you can do a combination of things. And a lot of it can be as simple as like healthy lifestyle can make a really big difference.
Mm. So if someone's dog is really important to them, let's name this dog Thor. Is it a matter of going to them and saying, hey, you know, I just want to make sure that Thor is getting everything that he needs. And so I want to make sure that you're able to do all of that. Have you thought about getting some help for this depression that you're in? Is that kind of where you're going with that?
I think the way you laid it out might be something you would do after you've gotten into the conversation a little bit more and the person's open to talking with you about it. You want to be careful and thoughtful about it. So if you go right for that, like I'm concerned about your dog and whether or not you're fully present for that part of your family, you know, if you do that too soon, then you might make the person defensive and they might feel like, well, I think I do a good job taking care of my dog. And I don't think I'm, you know, it's hard for people to think about their ability to function in different areas of their life sometimes, especially when you're kind of immersed in it. It can be hard to step back and really think about. So I would say you want to bring that into the conversation, but it might be in a little bit of a less direct way.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
So what's wrong with the blunt approach? I tend to be a really blunt person. And so I'm asking in a kind of devil's advocate way right now, because I've gotten in trouble for that before. But what's wrong with the bluntness approach of just saying, hey, you know what? I think you got some problems. You should go get that checked out. You're not doing too well. Yeah, it might be mental illness. Go get that checked out. What's wrong with just bringing the hammer down instead of tiptoeing around it?
Well, actually, I'm a pretty direct person myself, so I appreciate the bluntness.
Okay. And you and me will be straight with each other if it ever comes to that point.
Absolutely, for sure. I can guarantee you that too from me. But no, I think, again, that goes back to really thinking about the person and what you know about them and your relationship with them. And I think that some people are, depending on the rapport you have with them, the blunt approach might actually work really well. And you just have to think about what you know about that person. Is this somebody that wants me to be really direct and honest with them? Maybe that's the easiest and quickest way to have that conversation. But you might also know about someone that they are more sensitive about it, that maybe they're more guarded. And in those cases, then you need to be thoughtful and balanced in your approach.
How does a mental disorder affect someone's ability to recognize a mental disorder and to accept help? Like if somebody is in some danger, are they going to see it differently because of that disorder that's going on?
So your question makes me think of a couple of different things. One of them is insight, and then another one is readiness to change. You know, I'm trained as a clinical social worker, and I've been a therapist before, and then I've worked at Health Partners now for coming up on 12 years, and I've been a leader for case management programs, but now I have a responsibility for the health plan for all the different functions for behavioral health. And one of the things that we learn about in school, and this is a little bit more of a clinical concept or approach, but you could absolutely, anybody could understand it. But it's just thinking about where someone is at. And the reality is that sometimes people that are struggling with their mental health, they might be in a place where they don't fully recognize or acknowledge what's happening. They might be in a place where they're really having enough of a challenge that they're just kind of making it through the day, or, you know, they're experiencing a lot of these symptoms and challenges, but they might not fully understand or recognize, you know, I have depression or I have anxiety. So you got to think about their awareness and then also their readiness to change. Some people might have the awareness that they have a mental health concern, but they might not be willing to do anything about it yet. Mm. And so when you're talking to them, you've got to think about where the person's at and then work with it. If they really truly don't know quite yet that they might have depression or anxiety or something else, then broaching the subject would include talking to them about that. Mm. You know, you could ask questions like about how they're feeling, about how they're doing in their life, and then you could say, well, have you thought about this? Maybe you're experiencing depression. I think some of the Make It Okay campaign content is, it offers you suggestions about how to do some of that. But, you know, if somebody opens up to you and they are experiencing some of those concerns and symptoms, then what you can do is you can talk to them about ways to get help.
You work with a lot of employers. Health Partners does, Make It Okay does. You work with employers on the idea of mental health support, recognizing issues, addressing them, helping out the employees. Do mental disorders, common ones especially, depression, anxiety, trauma, do those present differently in the workplace than they do at home or in social circles?
Yes, they can. They can really impact productivity and how people are engaged with their jobs. And if you think about, for example, the last year that we've been through with the pandemic and then also the social justice issues and the stuff around racism and discrimination, people have been through an immense amount of stress this past year. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that there's some people that might have already had a mental health condition diagnosed before. And over the past year, all the stress from all this stuff going on might have worsened that, or there might be people that actually haven't yet been diagnosed, but maybe the stress of the last year has actually kind of pushed them to the point of maybe having a mental health condition or concern. So I think depression and anxiety has increased a lot. I know people have experienced a lot of loss in the last year with family members dying from COVID and just impacts their day-to-day life. So it's sometimes it can be hard to tease out the differences between like stress and people being overwhelmed. And then when does that cross over into a mental health concern? But absolutely, it impacts people at work. Where employers would really see it as overall productivity and again, how people are engaged with their jobs.
That's Quanna Walker. I should add that Health Partners and Make It Okay sponsored my previous podcast. They do not presently sponsor Depression Mode. I'm glad we got to touch on mental health in the workplace there at the end of that interview with Quanna. We have a link to our recent episode on burnout in the show notes for this episode, and it's in our archives. Basically, the message is, it's not your fault if you're getting burnt out. It's society's, maybe your boss's to some extent. Just ahead, before you check in with someone else, check yourself so you don't wreck yourself. We're talking about how to approach a loved one who you think might be having a mental health problem. And we're learning about the introspection that often comes first before you ever open your mouth in a conversation like that. I talked with Megan Oster-Rosen. She works with patients as a licensed clinical psychologist in Los Angeles. For the layperson, for the regular person who doesn't study psychology, who's not a therapist, who's not a psychiatrist, when should we worry about loved ones in terms of their mental health? What are red flags in someone else that could signal something wrong?
So there are so many different ways in which people struggle with mental health. So there's not really a one size fits all, but I would say a big one is when we see somebody withdrawing or kind of isolating. That's one where that sends up kind of my antenna. An increase in substance use, if that's something that somebody has a proclivity for. And then if we're kind of moving into more extreme suicidality stuff, then we're looking for somebody to be giving away their belongings, to suddenly quit their job, to kind of be wrapping things up in a way that's jarring and disconcerting. So it depends upon kind of what extent we're looking at. And that's not even looking at anxiety, which can also, you know, anxiety can look a little bit more manic. It can look like somebody can't stop, they can't land, they can't be present. They're always future tripping. They're always kind of thinking of the worst possible scenario and believing that that's happening. And the stakes always feel really, really high. So those are kind of the two ends of the spectrum when it comes to mood symptoms, anxiety and depression. And then there's always substance use. And then, of course, more extreme mental disorders like psychosis and things like
that. Yeah. So you're looking for big swings in behavior and big swings in kind of the way they're living their lives, I guess.
Those are big swings. It's not always a big swing. Sometimes it's a little swing. It's somebody who always was up to hang out with you and suddenly they're just not showing up anymore. And it just, you're kind of curious why, what's going on for them.
How can I encourage someone to at least look into getting professional help without making it worse? I think for a lot of people, the idea of saying, hey, you need to get professional help for your mind can be off-putting, I think.
Well, that is certainly not how I would phrase it.
Okay, good. You probably have more success.
I think starting off simply by checking in with the person. You know, one of the things that happens is that it feels so scary to acknowledge or name the fact that you've noticed a shift that we don't do it. And then the person can kind of feel unseen or unvalidated or feel like, oh, nobody cares about me. So I think it is important to just be able to say, hey, I notice that you're not coming out anymore, or the things that we used to do, you're not doing, or it seems like the things that used to give you pleasure aren't giving you pleasure anymore. One of the main symptoms of depression is something called anhedonia, which just means loss of pleasure. And so just saying that out loud, sometimes for the person can be a huge relief. You know, you noticed, somebody heard, somebody saw.
Yeah. It sounds to me like that form that you always fill out when you go see a psychiatrist or you go see somebody and it's like a rundown. You
sure.
Noticeably moving slower, loss of interest in activity,
yes.
Sleeping too much, sleeping not enough. Is it kind of, I don't know what the name of that form is, but I bet you do. Is it basically that?
Well, it can be that, but I also think that our culture very quickly moves people towards like a very sanitized version of what like a clean bill of mental health looks like. You need to get into therapy. You need to go see a psychiatrist and get on medication. I'm not saying that that's wrong. For a lot of people, that is something that would be very, very helpful for them.
Sure.
But it may not be the first thing that somebody's willing to hear. And it may not be the first thing to suggest, because there's a whole like spectrum of things that can help people feel differently and better that are not therapy or medication. I think what happens with any kind of like major depression is that we really experience a loss of meaning. We experience helplessness. We experience disconnection. And so are there ways that you can help this person feel reconnected, re-engaged, feel less helpless? And those would be kind of my first go-to before demanding or even suggesting going to see a therapist or a psychiatrist or both.
Yeah.
And they're not mutually exclusive. Like, you can do all these things at the same time, but I think it's important to just say it doesn't have to be cured by what we have decided is the like panacea for mental illness.
Right. I mean, we talk on this show sometimes about how there are mental disorders, you know, meaning it's really interfering with the basic function of your life. And then there's just feeling rotten, which is also a valid thing. And you know, stress getting to you and feeling down and feeling this darkness that you wish wasn't there. That's all within the realm of mental health. And it's not necessarily the same as you have this disorder. Please start taking these pills immediately.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of take issue with a lot of these things being disorders at all. For example, post-traumatic stress disorder. Is that a disorder that suddenly we're very hyper-vigilant or we're recreating these experiences to try to master them in our mind through flashbacks and or we're engaging in avoidance of things that make us feel scared? Is that a disorder? I don't know.
It seems like it would be if you're in that replay so often. And that replay is bound to lose. It's not gonna get processed through those endless loops, and it's affecting your sleep. It's affecting your ability to, you know, keep yourself clean. It's affecting your ability to get your kids to school. That seems like a disorder, doesn't it?
Sure. I mean, if it's affecting your functioning, but it's more of an injury that we're trying to repair all the time, and so. You know, we have to classify even gender dysphoria as a disorder. And that's how our insurance works to help people get the medical services that they may want or need. So we have to diagnose it. We have to classify it in that way just because of the system. But I don't know that it necessarily needs to be classified as a disorder.
Do you think the term disorder is corrosive, like because it's othering, because it says you have a disease and you think that's a block?
I mean, I think it can be. I can tell you that people who are diagnosed with personality disorders, that's like a huge rupture for them. There's something disordered about who I am in the world. And so, you know, for some people it's a relief. Oh, this is borderline personality disorder. These are the set of criteria that make sense. You know, these are the things that happen to me. Wow, there's treatment for this. But for others, it's like, I don't want to, that doesn't feel good to me that you are like putting in my chart that I have a disorder of like who I am.
Yeah. Yeah. It's odd, isn't it? That for some people it's reductive because you have this whole universe of complexities and we're hammering it into an insurance term so that the provider can get reimbursed for doing something that might help, to give something a shot.
Yeah.
But for other people, like I know when I first was told, you're not weird, you have major depressive disorder. Here's what happens when you get that. Here's some things we could try. It felt wonderful. It felt like a tremendous relief because it did. I felt not so unusual. I felt like I was part of the human species. So it can kind of cut both ways.
It can cut both ways. It absolutely can. But then you look at something like, say, COVID, right? Where over the course of what has been, like a year and a half now, and it's ongoing, just huge swaths of people are having a really strong emotional reaction to the experience of a pandemic. How do we classify that? And for a lot of people, it can be comforting to acknowledge that it's sort of a collective trauma. There's something happening to us as a society, and it's not just you that's suddenly having a reaction to the fact that you can't go to work, you're at home with your three kids trying to balance all these different things, and it's making you nuts, and it's kind of ruining your relationship and whatnot, etc.
We did an interview a few weeks ago with Joel Kim Booster, the comedian and writer, and he was in a deep depression canyon. I've rarely heard anyone like this. And I know intellectually, and I've told people, you can't cheer someone up out of a depression. That's not how depression works. The depression isn't a response to not remembering the cheerful things. And I've been doing this for years. I still found myself sucked in by saying, but look at all the wonderful things you have. Because I had this instinct to help him that was so strong that it overcame my better common sense. And what I wonder is, what are our limits as lay people to really help someone? Like, I can try to cheer someone up, but if it's real depression, if it's a clinical situation, that's just going to bounce off. It's probably going to make things worse. What should the average person, average non-therapist, non-psychiatrist person, keep in mind about their limitations?
So I have a multi-tiered response to this
awesome
question. Yes.
Perfect.
So first and foremost, it is a red flag when you find yourself trying to give solutions to somebody who is clearly experiencing some kind of depression. And that is something that I have to check myself as a therapist all the time. Why am I suddenly trying to like go through this person's life and solve these different issues? What's going on here? And then the person is saying, well, that's not going to help because of this, and that's not going to help because of that. And so what's happening is you're getting pulled in to mm-hmm. their experience of helplessness. Mm. That's something that depression does at everyone. So it's emanating from the person unconsciously, and it's that misery loves company. I'm going to pull everyone into my experience of helplessness so that they can understand what I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that I do as a therapist is just say that I just noticed that happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that now we're both having this experience of feeling helpless, and I just want to acknowledge how uncomfortable that is. Secondly, I don't necessarily expect that a layperson would be kind of attuned in that way, but I think you can start to notice, man, I keep giving this person advice. No matter what I say, they shoot it down. Nothing seems to be working. It's making me feel really frustrated with this friendship. I think there are opportunities to, first of all, stop giving suggestions and just acknowledge and hold space for the person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. A lot of people don't have that. It's just somebody saying, sounds like things are really hard. Why don't you just share with me a little bit? And you can make yourself vulnerable too. Man, like, it sounds like you're feeling really helpless. I've also had an experience of helplessness in this way, right? Because you get to do that. I don't really get to do that as a therapist.
No.
But you get to do that as a friend or as a family member. And that may help, it may not. They may be like, well, that doesn't show that you understand. Okay. Mm. Okay, you're right. But just starting by acknowledging and holding space, I think, is really, really useful. I think also just knowing your limitations and that it's not really your job to fix this person's external problems or internal problems. And always remember that, because we take it on. We feel it with them. We throw ourselves into the canyon so that they're not alone. And suddenly we're both just feeling this misery together. And it is shitty. I mean, it just sucks. Yeah. And it's really important to be able to notice when you start doing that. And some people do it more than others. And to be able to say, you know, I'm not going to get pulled into this. And to set boundaries for yourself, both around how much time you can spend with this person and how you spend time with this person, if that's how it's leaving you feeling.
It seems like a lot of this comes down to whether or not you're arguing with a condition. You know, if somebody is saying, this is what I'm feeling, this is what is happening within me, if you find yourself saying, well, no, it shouldn't be, or no, you know, I'm going to change that, it seems like that's where the problems really begin, is if you're trying to wipe out or trying to almost dismiss the problem the person is having, when you could just be bearing witness to it.
And I strongly discourage the word should. If you notice yourself shoulding someone or somebody shoulding themselves, I think we just have to wonder, why are we using this word here. Clearly, whatever should be happening isn't happening. So let's actually just be present with what is. And your phrase bearing witness is really key. Sometimes people just need their pain to be witnessed. And it makes them feel more connected. It makes them feel less alone.
Yeah, it's, but I think it's, I think the trick is, and I think the problem is, it's such a deep instinct to want your friend to be better. And so, you know, and there's no logical way to get there. So flummoxed, you just say, get better, essentially. And
yeah. Yeah.
And that's the wall.
And that's for you.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not even for them.
Right.
Right.
I want to have a more pleasant encounter with my friend.
Yeah.
Stop being depressed.
I am almost 9 months pregnant right now.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm pretty much due in like a couple of weeks. And one of the things that I've noticed as a pregnant person is that people are very much projecting their pregnancy experiences and trying to process their own, just like the psychedelic experience of having been pregnant, having given birth, and having a baby onto me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about me. It's about them. And they're trying to help. It's always coming from a good place, but it's taken me a second to just be like, wait a second, why is this person like vomiting all this advice at me?
Yeah.
Unsolicited. And it happens a lot with grief too. So it seems like the two, like the entry and exit into the world.
They're all hanging out by the doors.
Yes. And people feel really helpless. They feel like it's really chaotic and they don't have control. And so I've experienced a number of losses in my life, and people have said the craziest things to me in reaction to their own discomfort around my losses. And so we just have to remember, like, who is this for? Why are you saying these things? And if sometimes we say things and then we can backtrack and be like, wow, I just said something that probably was really not connected to your experience, friend, family member, whoever is suffering. I'm sorry that I said that. Let's get back to what's happening for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe it's a matter of, I've gone through this hell of grief. I've gone through this amazing and very, in a lot of different ways, experience of pregnancy or of, you know, being the partner of a pregnant person. This has got to count for something. Maybe I can use it here. I've got this wealth of information, you know, I can't monetize it. I don't know what else to do with it, but yeah, in it can be reductive. Like when I've been grieving and people tell me the worst things about their grief, I'm like, well, shit, now I got that now too. And now I've got to carry around both of our grief.
Yeah.
It can be a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So people should shut up more is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Selectively.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we solved that one.
Yeah. What's the next topic?
That's Megan Oster-Rosen. She's a licensed clinical psychologist in LA. Next time on Depression Mode, she doodled during school and then she just kept doodling and now she has a TV show about some birds who are best friends.
I don't know. Like, I've never been officially diagnosed with like ADD or anything, but maybe it's like a form of that where I needed to kind of do those two things at the same time. Because if I was just sitting there not drawing, like, I don't know, I think I would have lost my mind. It's just too, I can't sit still and not do anything.
Lisa Hannawalt, creator of the animated show Tuca and Birdie, is with us. Hey, if people support our show through a small donation, we will continue to exist. If not, we won't. If you donate, you make Depression Mode happen, and we thank you. If you haven't donated, it's easy. You can find a level that works for you. MaximumFun.org/join. Also, give our sponsors a shot. Use those discount codes they offer. That stuff is tracked, so you're getting good stuff, cheaper, and you're helping the show. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. Also, remember to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. All of that helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations going. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about, what you thought of the shows, just anything you have in mind. Brownie recipes. You can email us. Our electric mail address is depreshmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Great talk going on over there. There's some topics that we're working on right now for future episodes that germinated there in the Preshies group. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depresh Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Just search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Mo, all one word. Hello, credits listeners. Baseball Hall of Famer Johnny Bench could hold 7 baseballs in one hand, which was great until someone said, "Hey, Bench, hand me 8 baseballs with one hand." Not so tough now, are you, Johnny Bench? Depresh Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hey, this is Amy from Rockville, Maryland, and I want you to know that your worst moments do not define you.
Depresh Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Mo. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.